Welcome to the first book show for 2014. Hopefully you got lots of books for Christmas, and we'll be bringing you lots of book interviews and discussions over the coming year. Get in touch by email bookshow@rte.ie or find us on Twitter and Facebook at bookshowrte. On the show this evening, we talk to Lisa Darms about her book on the Riot Girl movement of the 1990s.
It's both this really intimate, private thing that was shared between girls in safe spaces, but at the same time, it tried to be a very public movement that appealed and recruited girls.
But first on the book show, the rise of young adult fiction and crossover books. In studio in a few minutes, I'll be chatting with children's books editor for Penguin Ireland, David Mabry, and writer Sheena Wilkinson. But obviously, we'd like to hear from the young adults reading these books, so we went along to Cabinteely Youth Theatre and asked some 14 to 17-year-olds what they're reading.
I've read stuff like historical stuff like The Guns of Easter, and there's this young boy and he tries to help his family during the World War when they're all poor and they barely have any food.
But I'll always remember like the book by Mallory Blackman, Noughts and Crosses. I don't know, I just always liked it. It was probably the first kind of more adult book that I'd read. Blacks are the superior race and whites are the inferior race, and it's just really about this boy and girl who were best friends, and he's white and she's black, and they just can't understand why they can't be friends and can't grow up together.
I mainly just read books that take teenage life and turn them into fantasy and stuff like that, so like the Harry Potter, Skullduggery Pleasant and Cherub. It was one of those book series that it kind of evolved with the reader, so it started off and the character would be in his 13 and he'd, it's a spy kind of book, espionage kind of book, so he'd join the spy agency, and then as you go through the books he'd age with you, so you'd read a book a year and it would be by the end he's 17 and he's kind of ahead of you, but like I'm 16, so by the time I'd read that it was kind of matching with the time, so I'd kind of know what he's talking about.
The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Suns, they're like completely different to the books I would normally read because they're about places like Pakistan and Iran and all those different places, and like about the Taliban and how women were treated and how everything is completely different, and it's nice to kind of get a different aspect of other people's lives. I don't know, I like reading books that are slightly older for me anyway, so it gives me something, like it's a challenge.
I mainly read say, fantasy or science fiction, which I really enjoy. I use reading as just a relaxing thing. I find those genres kind of allow me to escape from everyday life a lot more so than anything more serious or heavy.
Well, to be honest, a very popular book that a lot of teenagers I know like is The Fault in Our Stars by John Green. It's a very philosophical book. It's a very down-to-earth book because it's not just a very happy ending. It's not very, oh, everything is great and everything is perfect. And it takes you through this journey of this person's world, which isn't perfect, and you get to be there and you get to travel with them and you can experience the same experiences as they do.
I'd read Fantastic Mr. Fox by Roald Dahl all the way to kind of really serious novels and really deep ones such as Out of My Mind by Sharon Draper. It's about a young girl, she's in a wheelchair and she can't speak, but she's got this absolutely brilliant mind. And it's all about how her parents think she's dumb and how everyone thinks she's dumb, and she's really this brilliant, smart young woman, and it's all about how she deals with it. And then a wonderful thing happens. She gets this special wheelchair and she's able to type out what she's saying, and it just brought me to tears. And it's the same way that Mr. Fox jumping up and down like brings you to laughter. It's just, I don't want to be a typical teenage Dublin girl. I want to be someone that's older than me, younger than me, in a completely different situation, so I can kind of discover what it's like to be in that situation and not kind of get outside what I know and learn more things. And so I go for that in my books.
And to discuss some of the thoughts we've heard in that Vox, I'm joined in studio by Sheena Wilkinson and David Mabry. And David, isn't it great to hear so many young people so enthusiastic and avid about reading? Because, I mean, teenagers, they're hard, you're straddling two worlds, it's difficult. But how can fiction actually help with that?
It opens worlds that they might not access otherwise, and voices and experiences that they might not see. Or it reinforces things that they're already feeling and they know that they're not going insane.
Is that what young readers tell you, Sheena, when you meet them?
Absolutely, yes. My books tend to be very realistic. They're contemporary realism. They're set in Ireland. And when I do go around to schools, one of the things that people say is, we loved reading your book because it was like reading about us, and, you know, it was realistic and it was down to earth. And it was interesting listening to those teenagers. Some of them wanted to read to escape. Some of them wanted to read to see themselves reflected. And I guess, you know, we all read for different reasons. And young adult fiction is so diverse that whatever you're into, you'll find what you need.
Is there a sense as well with young adult fiction that does it have a goal and that it's giving young people maybe confidence or weapons to sort of fight their own battles in the real world? Do they get that from books?
I think they can probably get that from everything.
Yeah.
And to be honest, young adult fiction, as much as every other type of fiction, is entertainment first, or at least it should be.
Yeah, I think it has to be a good story. It has to be entertaining, or they're not going to want to engage with it. And we've certainly moved on a long way from when children's literature was didactic and when teenage fiction, I mean, it went through a ghastly stage of just being, well, of not just being, but a lot of it being about issues. And, you know, teenagers can spot that kind of thing a mile off, and they don't want to read a book that's just about issues. It has to be a good story. But I think if it does help them to deal with something or just to see, possibly to see their own life reflected, but also to see the life reflected of somebody who isn't them and who might have problems that they'll never have. But if they have been able to empathise with that in a book, it might actually help them to empathise, you know, with somebody in real life who is the loser or, you know.
And it's completely changed. The landscape of media has changed so much that any reader now is so more media savvy. So books are competing with television, with internet, with games, that they're not looking just for tools to survive with, they're looking for something completely different.
It does seem that it's a very new classification in lots of ways. I mean, there was a long time ago we didn't have those writers. We had maybe Judy Bloom, but, you know, we didn't have a YA section in a library or in the bookstore. Who do we have to thank for that huge rise in popularity? Is it as obvious as Harry Potter or The Hunger Games?
It really is. It's J.K. Rowling. The market changed with the release and the success of Harry Potter. And the whole game shift changed. I'm not saying they didn't exist before.
Yeah, because, I mean, they certainly did exist. I mean, I've always read young adult fiction and I've always found excellent young adult fiction. But I think what the Harry Potter phenomenon did was that it made it more commercial and it made it more acceptable and it made it something that people were actually interested in because it was making money.
And it created a market which didn't exist before, where previously children's books were Goosebumps, Christopher Pike, were
but
the only
a lot
commercial...
More than that,
well, no,
David.
They were the commercial outlets for children's fiction, where it shifted everything and it opened reading children's books and teen fiction to a much wider audience that wouldn't.
Yeah, the market was always there, but I think the Harry Potter phenomenon took it out of the school library, out of the library, and, you know, I think suddenly they realised that there were a lot of kids with a lot of spending power.
Yeah, and that's what it is now. It's children's books is now 23, nearly 25% of the reading market in Ireland.
And that doesn't mean that all those people reading are children.
No, it doesn't, but that's part of the glory of it.
Absolutely.
Certainly for young adult fiction, the majority of people reading it are adult in terms of age. I mean, they may be 20 to 35, but they're still adult. They're not teenagers.
But Sheena, you've your PhD, you've talked about the crossover between adult and children's fiction. I mean, are those distinctions even helpful? Is a good book a good book? Does it matter what age you are?
I think a good book is a good book. And I think one of the brilliant things nowadays is that adults are much happier about being seen reading young adult fiction. I mean, one of your participants there talked about John Green's book, The Fault in Our Stars, which obviously has been phenomenally successful. And, you know, adults are not going to be embarrassed to be seen reading that book on the bus, whereas 20 years ago, adults might have felt embarrassed about reading children's books. Although I have to say, I never did. But then I'm a children's writer.
It is. I mean, it touches on a lot of subjects, that book, but it is still a coming of age story. Are most of the young adult fiction books, is that what they're focused on? That idea of you know, going from a younger life into an adult world and growing up, essentially?
Yes.
Mostly.
I'd say it's
irrespective of the type of book, be it dystopian fantasy or science fiction or realistic fiction like John Green or David Levithan.
Or Sheena Wilkinson,
who's sitting right next to me. It doesn't really matter what the story is around it. It's always about the voice and it's always about the inter personal relationships with the characters?
Well, in examining the idea of what young adult fiction should be, there's been a lot of discussion about what is too controversial for teenagers to read. Patrick Ness has won the highest award for children's literature, the Carnegie Medal, twice, not just once. His work deals with death and is hard-hitting. Zoe Cummins went to speak to him about what is appropriate for teenagers to read.
Here is the boy, drowning. In these last moments, it's not the water that's finally done for him. It's the cold.
More Than This is Patrick Ness's latest novel. It opens with a boy drowning, desperate and alone in his final moments.
He is strong and young, nearly 17, but the wintry waves keep coming, each one seemingly larger than the last.
Ness's books are gritty, unpredictable and dark, unlike anything he read growing up.
When I was a teenager, there was nothing like the variety and breadth of teenage books you could get these days. And so I, like most people my age and of my generation, went right from kids' books to adult books. And I've written about this quite a bit, actually, about the idea that you pick up a book because it's a little too old, and because it's a little transgressive, and because it's a little dangerous.
Children's literature critic and lecturer Robert Dunbar says a teenager's curiosity isn't a license for writers to preach.
That is the last thing that 15 and 16 year olds want to have put in front of them.
So what is age appropriate then for young adult readers?
Controversial, difficult, contemporary, taboo subjects, if there are any of those left, that the books of someone like Patrick Ness tend to deal with. The key is not that they deal with them, it seems to me. The key aspect is, do they deal with them responsibly?
The most popular young adult books on the shelves are often set in other worlds. But can they still be relevant to the real issues facing young people?
Teenagers don't recognise it as dystopia. They see it as a kind of extrapolation of their current emotional state. I mean, high school feels a lot like a dystopian world. You know, you could go into why that's true. And so they see it as sort of barely disguised fiction.
I think there is just the possibility that reading about them in, if you like, fictional terms, and maybe especially perhaps in fictional parallel worlds, gives them an insight into the reality of what is around them.
Teenagers think about things like genocide, they think about things like suicide, and so it's my responsibility to again try to address them truthfully, non-sensationally. Otherwise, I feel like I'm leaving the teenage reader to face it themselves. I think that's the immoral position, to leave a teenager just to fend for themselves. I think that's the wrong idea.
I don't think any longer that we need to shield our young people, our 15, 16, 17 year olds, from any of these things. But the book should have something to say, especially perhaps about the adult world that eventually all young adults, by definition, are going to enter.
Ness challenges and captivates young readers by stretching the boundaries of age-appropriate writing.
You want to portray teenagers accurately, but if you do it completely accurately, they'd never be able to read it, because the way teenagers speak, outside of where and when an adult is around, is just, you know, it peels the paint off a wall. I mean, I know this is personal experience, because when I was a teenager, I was a really good kid. Like, get me alone with other teenagers and, oh God, I could just swear like a truck driver.
Blacking out, or here, bleeping out, is Ness's solution to bad language in his short story, Different for Boys.
There are a lot of places this story could start, but it might as well start on the first day of year 11, when Charlie and me are sitting in geography waiting for Mr. Bacon to get his seating plan in order. Well, this is taking bleeping forever, Charlie says, then he blinks surprised. What the bleep just happened? What are these bleeping black boxes? I shrug. It's that kind of story, I say. Certain words are necessary because this is real life, but you can't actually show them because we're too young to read about the stuff we actually do, yeah? Charlie nods solemnly at the truth of this. Then he smirks. Bleeping bleep 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 bleep, he says. His smile gets bigger. Bleep 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 bleep. He nods again. Cool.
And if bleeping isn't enough, maybe it's just down to trusting the next generation.
Kids are great censors, and if this book's not for them just yet, they'll put it down. So, I mean, I did that all the time. I read stuff that was too old for me. Didn't understand some of it, but I was never scarred by it, ever. I mean, I think it's a good thing. I think it's a mind-opening.
Zoe Cummins reporting there. Sheena Wilkinson and David Mabry are in studio with me now discussing young adult fiction. Sheena, surely as we heard in that report about age appropriateness, that part of the excitement as a teenager when you're reading is finding content you didn't know anything about or discovering something that breaks boundaries. But is that potentially dangerous too?
I think the important word that Patrick used there was the word responsible. It's not that teenagers do not know about things like suicide, and the content is there. They're going to find stuff on the internet, for example. And I think the thing that a writer can do that is maybe different from what they're going to find in other media is we can write about it in a way which is thoughtful, which is perhaps, it's immediate, but it's not like, for example, when I was doing research into teenage hanging, which is something that I have written about in Grounded, I found some stuff online which was really quite disturbing, you know, and I'm 45. And I think, you know, when people read a book, they're reading it in a quieter way, and it's just, you know, it's not, I don't think it's making them deal with things that they haven't been aware of, but it's maybe doing it in a different, less graphic kind of way, possibly.
Would you maybe read a section from Grounder to give us a sense of what you're talking about?
I would, certainly. This is just after Declan, who's the 18-year-old protagonist, has found a 14-year-old neighbour who has just taken his own life, and this is at the funeral. We get to the chapel early, but it's already filling up, even though people don't really know the family. But all the neighbours come. It's as if they're saying, if we come to the funeral of this kid, it can't happen to our kids. The coffin is already at the altar when we go in. It's draped in a Liverpool flag. I never even knew he liked football. I can't help wondering if he really did or if somebody thought it was the right thing to put on a teenager's coffin.
Well, you mentioned very real situations, and David, in the box we heard from Patrick Ness, he talks about, you know, dystopian settings can be as familiar as high school. What about those real and contemporary situations, as Sheena discusses, as Patrick Ness talks about? Aren't they more useful to teenagers? And again, we've talked about John Green's book, which touches on cancer.
I don't know. I don't know how real John's, like, Fault in Our Stars is. I mean, it's based on a group of kids who are all terminal cancer patients. As real as that is, and as harrowing as the subject matter is, it isn't about dying of cancer. It's about the people involved in it and all of their relationships. And a pair of them fall in love and go on a hunt for an author. Hmm. And it's their favourite author, and they must meet him and find out how the book ends that he never finished. So it is far less about, and as much as it is about cancer, it's far less about that than it is about their relationships.
Sheena, do you also feel that, as Robert Dunbar said, that this is also about not lecturing to kids and how writers avoid being patronising? And, you know, who do you think is more successful at doing that?
I think, well, obviously, you know, writers like Mallory Blackman, who was mentioned, John Green, Patrick Ness, obviously, Karen David, you know, writers who do not... I mean, the thing is, kids, if you in any way try to patronise them, they just throw the book away. And something that has been mentioned a couple of times is voice, and it's that voice has to be authentic. And, you know, I think somewhere you have to be able to access what it felt like to be. I mean, personally, I mean, I'm 45, but I remember what it felt like to be 16. And if I couldn't remember that, then I have no business trying to write for 16-year-olds.
There's a Madeleine Longell quote where she says, if the book is too difficult to write for adults, I'll write it for children. It's that the idea that a teenager is more acceptable and more open to thinking of a much larger scale, as Patrick said, things like genocide and suicide. It's what's in their daily thoughts. Like, they're thinking on much bigger scales because they're being introduced to ideas for the first time, and they're kind of realising how big the world is.
Yeah, and they don't take so much for granted, and, you know, they have a kind of an intensity and a freshness which, you know, I think young adults are, they're probably the most demanding people to write for, but they're also the most rewarding.
Yes.
Because when they like you, they're so loyal and they're also so honest, and if they don't like something, they will tell you, and they will tell you face to face.
Well, the way we're reading, I think, is changing an awful lot. The way we consume, we're not just going to the library and getting books, we're all reading digitally. Do you think that ebook adaptability has become a big issue for writers now in this genre specifically?
No, I don't see it as an issue. I mean, it's the same as the rest of publishing, that ebooks are a fact. It's just another way of delivering the text and the words. The only thing is, you're now on a device where you have to compete with video games and with the internet, and somebody can just as quickly swipe three fingers to the right and jump into their Twitter stream as read the next chapter in Grounded.
Yeah.
It's becoming more and more competitive, and that teen fiction, as much as any fiction, needs to maintain that pace and maintain that relationship with the readers.
Although, interestingly, although teenagers are, of course, always on their, you know, various sort of devices, phones and tablets and things, from what I understand, kids' books are not downloaded as e-books as much as adult books are.
Kids' books as a whole aren't. Young adult fiction and kind of into that, when you hit kind of past the age of 15 onwards, yeah, that kind of fiction is. But for kids' books, and when, certainly for picture books and younger middle grade fiction, it hasn't translated, and it doesn't translate as well into digital space.
No.
I remember seeing a Posy Simmons cartoon where somebody asks a children's writer, oh, when are you going to write a proper book? Do you think there's a snobbishness about writing YA fiction?
I think less so than there used to be.
Well, I think there is still.
Well, I mean, you know, Martin Amis famously.
The brain injury.
You know, yeah. But, you know, he didn't make, make many
friends.
Tell
me that quote again. He said something about the,
I'd only write for teenagers and children, or only write for children if I had a serious brain injury.
Yeah. You know, my decision to write for young adults was because that was the kind of thing that I like to read, and I like to write about people encountering things for the first time, and, you know, and that lends itself to young adult fiction. There probably is a bit of snobbery, but I'd say it's better than it was.
It's,
I don't know, because I've only been published for just over 3 years, so I don't know what it used to be like, but
it is far less than it ever was.
Yeah.
And as people become more aware of young adult fiction and children's fiction, and as teenagers, I mean, the market when I was growing up was a very different ballgame to when Sheena was growing up, or when my parents were growing up, that there's more acceptance to it now. And I'll never turn to someone and say, well, when are you going to write a real book?
Mm.
So it's becoming less and less likely.
Well, at least this discussion has reassured me that young people at least are still reading, which is always a good
so.
Thing. My thanks to David Mabry and Sheena Wilkinson.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now it seems logical to move from young adult fiction to teenage revolution. Lisa Darm's new book, The Riot Girl Collection, gathers ephemera, photographs and the history of a mainly female underground activist scene. I went along to find out more about the Riot Girl archive. Riot Girl was a 90s feminist punk movement championed by bands such as Excuse 17 and Bikini Kill. I'm here in the Fales Library in New York University to have a look at the Riot Girl collection with curator Lisa Darms.
Okay, so we're headed into the American Wing, which is where we keep most of our archives, including the Riot Girl collection. Well, this is where the archives start. So right now in the Riot Girl collection consists of 16 individual archives, and they're actually all right here in this row.
Alongside the music scene was a subculture centered around activism, manifestos, and zines, items not usually found in a university archive.
Backdrops from punk shows, you know, set designs, flyers, buttons, t-shirts. So those are all materials that also show up in the Riot Girl collection that quote, traditional archive might not consider to be something with research value.
Kathleen Hanna was one of the most outspoken and prominent founders of the Riot Girl movement, alongside Joanna Fateman. Any of their work that survives or can be traced is right here.
These ones are easier to get out and
they
flip them open. Yeah.
Let's have a look. Yeah. And we're looking at right in front of us here is Joanna Fateman. Are these her papers, her work that she accrued, things that she'd collected herself?
Johanna's paper would represent her entire career as an artist, as a critic, as a member of the band La Tigra. And
just below we have Kathleen Hanna's
boxes
as well.
And that's
a huge figurehead of that movement.
Exactly. And this is pretty much the cornerstone collection for us. Really the first donation and her involvement in the collection is really what made it possible, because she was able to work with me, emphasize why she thought it was important to start preserving this history now.
Everybody these days has Instagram and Twitter accounts and blogs and everything sort of online. But, you know, before we had the internet, we had zines. What was a zine?
Well, zine actually has a long history as a fanzine. So it would be written by as a fan of a particular subject. So in the 50s, you might have had fans of science fiction, writing zines about science fiction subjects. And then with punk, it became often focused very much on music. It might be reviews of shows or reviews of albums. Definitely handmade, cut and paste, going to your local Kinko's or a copy store in the middle of the night and meticulously copying and recopying. And then another big aspect of zines was then circulation. So you might share zines at a punk show with maybe someone you don't know, and that's how you come to meet them. Or you might create a network of friendships, you know, internationally even by mailing zines to each other.
Riot Girl had two main threads of zines.
One was a collectively authored and very revolutionary and political, and the other was more personal and would often be written by a single girl, perhaps in her bedroom in a suburban house.
These two styles are combined here in some of Hannah's work.
This would be about 1991, this one. And what I love about it is that it's actually designed so that you can fold it up in fours, and on the front it says trust. So it's, in a way, a metaphor for me for the Riot Girl movement and how it's both this really intimate, private thing that was shared between girls and in safe spaces, but at the same time, it tried to be a very public movement that appealed and recruited girls. And so this flyer is both a little intimate kind of invitation that you could hand to somebody one-on-one, but you could also open it up and it becomes more of a broadsheet or a flyer that you could hang on a wall with a little manifesto. The revolution starts here and now within each one of us.
Lisa Darm's book, The Riot Girl Collection, charts the cultural activism and ephemera of the movement and hopes to inspire new generations.
So creating the book was an opportunity to get it to a wider audience and particularly to teenage girls now was my secret hope and dream. And it's also a way for people to find out about the collection and also realize that they might want to donate to it.
The Riot Girl Collection is published by the Feminist Press. That's all we have time for this evening on the show. Sheila Neveal and Kevin McCluskey were on sound. The book show is produced by Zoe Cummins, and we'll leave you this evening with Regan Hutchins and a footnote.
Wordsworth was a poet and McGovern a politician. Their names are good aptronyms, or names which aptly suit their owner. Here's another one. William Page, a publisher. In 1579, he published a naughty pamphlet begging Queen Elizabeth I not to marry a wicked French suitor. She was enraged and ordered that his right hand be cut off.
No!
The man who wrote the pamphlet also suffered the same fate. Before the axe fell, he punned, "Pray for me now, my calamity is at hand." Then, with his left hand, he lifted his hat and cried, "God save the Queen!" before swooning. His name was John Stubbs. Aptronym, or what's in a name?
The Book Show was presented by Sinead Gleeson.